Good morning and welcome at Dev Days on this Friday, and welcome at my presentation about SharePoint 2010 Developers Mythbusters. We'll be talking about common myths or misunderstandings that developers might have about SharePoint development. And I think it's both interesting for SharePoint developers that have been working with SharePoint for quite a while, as it is for .NET developers that want to start working with SharePoint. This is me. My name is Mirjam van Olst. I'm a Microsoft Certified Master in SharePoint 2007 and SharePoint 2010. I'm also an MVP. I work for Avanade here in the Netherlands as a SharePoint architect, and I'm one of the organizers of the Dutch Information Worker User Group. If you want to check out our free SharePoint e-magazine, or if you want to register for SharePoint-related events, check out diewug.nl, our website. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can do so via my blog, Twitter, or my email. These are the myths that we'll be talking about. I've categorized them a little bit in the same order in which you would develop your solutions. So we start with setting up our environments, where one of the myths is that devs don't need to know anything about SQL Server if they work with SharePoint. Service applications are only interesting for admins. Then we go into building our solution, where one of the myths is that any good ASP.NET developer is also a good SharePoint developer. And useful development for Office 365 is impossible. Then we'll go and we'll deploy our solution, and we'll talk about SP web config modifications for a bit and see whether they are, in fact, the best things in sliced bread. And then we'll talk about maintaining your solution and about upgrading an existing solution and maybe retracting and cleaning up a solution. So we'll start with setting up your environment, and we'll talk a little bit about SQL Server and SharePoint. SQL is an essential part of any SharePoint environment. Without SQL, SharePoint won't run, and actually all of the data that you see in SharePoint and even a lot of the configuration of SharePoint is stored in SQL Server. That means that SharePoint can't serve pages any faster than that SQL can. So if SQL can't handle any requests, SharePoint won't serve you any data. So a slow SharePoint production environment is often actually a slow SQL environment. And that can be blamed on your customizations. So, you know, if you're a SharePoint developer and you've built customizations for a customer, anytime an environment is slow, you run the risk of getting the blame of that slow SharePoint environment, when in fact it might be a misconfigured SQL environment or even a misconfigured SharePoint environment. A slow SharePoint development environment, so your SQL development instance, means that you'll be waiting a lot while you're developing and you will actually be a lot less productive. So SQL installation and maintenance should be high priorities, even on your development environment. If we look at SQL maintenance, we have database fragmentation. If we want to defragment a database, we should defragment the index and not the table, because that's actually what SQL uses to get data from SQL Server. If you have fragmentation, it will take a lot longer for a request to be served, because SQL has to look for the data instead of that it can just pick it up from where it expects it to be. If you have a fragmented database, you can either reorganize your database or rebuild your database. If you have, say, up to 10% of fragmentation, you can reorganize your index, and you can do that online, so you don't have to take your database offline. If you have between 10 and 75% of database fragmentation, you have to rebuild your index, but you can still do that online. If you have more than 75% of fragmentation, and that's a lot, then you have to actually take your database offline in order to rebuild it. SharePoint can help you with that. If you have your health analyzer running, SharePoint can manage the database fragmentation for you. You can see there at the bottom here the rule. Databases used by SharePoint have fragmented indexes. It's a health rule that runs daily, and it has a repair automatically option in there, and it can actually repair that automatically. So if you have this enabled, you don't have to do that yourself. So SharePoint will take care of the database fragmentation for you. Unless you have turn this off for a long time, it's really, really fragmented, and then you want to turn it on, then you might actually have to rebuild, which you have to do yourself. SharePoint won't take your database offline. if you have a large database and maybe you threw away some data from it, don't shrink your database because shrinking will cause fragmentation in a database. You should see it like this. You have your database with a bit of information. Maybe you deleted a bit next to it. You added another bit in there. You deleted something. You added something in there. Now, if you're going to shrink that database and take out that empty those empty spaces in between, the last bit of data will be put in the first hole. So you can see how that messes up the order of your data completely if you keep doing that. So to shrink a database first and then to defragment it will actually keep you busy for a long time because you will shrink and then refragment. So only shrink your database if you have more than 50% of your database empty and you don't expect it to fill up anytime soon again. Another bit of SQL Server maintenance is run CheckDB. CheckDB will check the integrity of all the objects in your server or in your database. And if you do that once a week, it will check for any inconsistencies, and you might be able to find potential problems in your database very early on, instead of when your database is already corrupt and you can't fix it anymore. By default, SQL will use all the memory it can get its hands on any environment, and that's because of the default settings of SQL. So SQL will use as much memory as you can give it on your SharePoint environment, on your development environment. Usually a development environment doesn't have that much memory, and you usually have SQL Server and SharePoint running on the same server. So what you want to do is limit the amount of memory that SQL can use. There's a setting in the general settings of your SQL Server. This is the default. I can't even pronounce that number. So you should set it to something that you might actually have in your server. So, 2 gig of memory for a SQL server on your development environment is pretty reasonable. Obviously, if you have really fancy big environments, you can give it more. But give it something reasonable. Leave something over for SharePoint and your operating system to run as well. If we start talking about SQL Server backups, obviously on a production environment, you need to think about what strategy you want to use. Do you want to use a full recovery model, where you will back up every bit of data from SQL? You will do full backups, maybe differential backups as well, and log backups to get as much data back as possible when you have a potential crash. If you do a full backup, that will contain both the data and the transaction logs. If you have your recovery strategy of your SQL Server database set to full, you must make backups. If you don't make full backups and you have your recovery model set to full, your log will grow indefinitely for that database. It will never be cleared. No sections of that log will be set as inactive and reused. So because of that, it will just keep growing. If you have a development environment that you've been working on for a while, and you've installed that with pretty much the default settings of SQL, and you put SharePoint on top of that, you should check out the log files for your databases, especially for your content databases. Because usually, especially content databases, have their recovery model by default set to full. But who makes backups of the databases on their development environments? I don't. I don't even need those backups. But because of that, I should set a recovery model of my content databases, actually all my databases, on my development environment to simple, so that my logs won't grow that big, and I won't use up useless space on my development environment. If you make differential backups, they will always be differential from the last full backup. If you do log backups, so that's only the little bits after the last differential backups, those are incremental from the last log backup. So if you do a full backup, you have your full backup first, then you have a differential, which is differential to the last full backup, and then you have a lot of log backups. So if you want to restore as much data as possible, you first restore your full backup, then on top of that you restore your differential backup, and then you restore all the different log bits that you had left as well. Now, if you don't need to keep all your data, if it's not that important, if it's okay to lose some, you might not need all your log backups as well. You may just want to do full backups, and that might be enough for you. But it depends, obviously, on the data that's in the environment and on what your customer wants from you. If you have your recovery model set to full, and say you do a full backup every week, you do a differential backup once a day, and you do log backups once an hour, just an example. If you do, in the middle of the week, a full backup for another purpose, someone's asking for a copy of the database, be aware that the next differential backups will look at that full backup that you did in the middle of the week. So if you copy that off the server and just remove it, you won't be able to restore your database, because that last full backup, only you can only add the differential backups before that full backup to that. So you will miss a lot of data. So don't just make full backups to basically hand someone a database without thinking about it. Be aware of what you're doing and of what your SQL Server is doing. You also have to think about what databases you want to backup. You can physically backup every database that you want, but SharePoint doesn't support restoring all databases. For instance, you can't restore your configuration database, so there's not much use backing it up. It's just not supported to do that. What you also need to do is think about your RPO, your recovery point objective, how much data loss is acceptable, and your RTO, which is your recovery time objective, so how much downtime is acceptable. If you have really, really large content databases, your RTO will be bigger by definition, because it will take you longer to restore a database. If you have your backup stored on a tape that is shipped to the other side of the world every day, it will take you a long time to get that tape back. So think about how long you can have your environment be down. You also have to think about where you will be writing your backup to. Writing your backup to the same disk that your SQL Server is actually running on is not very useful. Even the same server is a bit dubious. So make sure that you write it to something that will actually be saved in case your SQL Server crashes. And test your backup and restore procedures before needing the actual restore. I've really seen customers that did, you know, had their backup strategy, did backups every day or so they thought. The files were written to disk, you could see that. Database crashed, they wanted to restore. Restore didn't work, so they had nothing. All their data was lost. So don't just make backups, but also test if you can restore them. A backup is useless if you can't restore it. We'll move on to the service application model. In SharePoint 2010, this is a new concept, and it replaces the old 2007 shared service providers. The new service applications provide us with a lot more flexibility than that the old shared service providers did. We can easily scale out. We can run services on more than one server. We could never do that before. We can much easier share services across farms. We could share shared service providers before, but that was pretty difficult configuration, and it usually didn't work. You can have more than one instance of a certain service application being deployed to your one farm. So for instance, if you want more managed metadata service applications, which is a good example of one that you can use multiple times, and that's also one that can be shared across farms very easily, you can just create more than one of that. And web applications can pick and choose which service applications they want to use. So you can have, I have a picture of this, which will actually explain it a lot easier. But per web application, you can choose whether it, for instance, needs Excel services, or maybe it just doesn't, or whether you want it to consume from one managed metadata service application or from another one. This could be interesting, for instance, if you have content type hubs, where you want different web applications to inherit different content types. For the terms, usually, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to make more than one managed metadata service application unless you have more than a million terms in there. And I would like to see users pick from that. It also provides service isolation. So with each service application now uses a different database instead of just having one big shared services database. So your data is actually separated. And optionally, you can also use separate application pools. But I wouldn't recommend that unless you really, really need it. That application pool basically only hosts the web service of that service application, so how much good does it do you to have a different application pool for each service application? Each application pool will consume resources from your server, so if you don't really need more than one application pool for your services, just use one. A little bit of the terminology around service applications, because Microsoft did a great job again at making it as confusing as possible. The service application itself is basically just the logical container of the service. And if you go into Central Administration and you browse to Manage Service Applications, you can see all your service applications listed in there. The service application endpoint is the IIS virtual application that is created within the SharePoint web services site within IIS. and it runs on all the machines that are running the service. So if you go into services on server in SharePoint, in central administration, and you start it, it will actually create those IIS virtual applications in on all the servers where you clicked start for. Then we have the service instance, the implementation of the functionality provided. So you see that here. So this is where you can start a service. And you see here, for instance, I have SharePoint Foundation search stopped and SharePoint server search started. And you can also do this on a per service server basis. You can also see that these services have actual Windows services that match that. That's not always the case. But in this case, you can see that when I start Foundation Search, I will also start my SharePoint Foundation Search V4 in my services on my server. And the same is true for SharePoint Server Search 14. We also have service application proxies, which are also called service connections, which are also called service associations, which is the link between the web application and the service application. So as you can see here, I have a my-side web application with a custom application proxy group, which matches these service applications to my web application. And then I have my default one, which is default proxy group, which by default, all service applications are added into the default proxy group unless you tell them you don't want that. And you see the portal uses also the WSS usage application, which the my sites don't. So you can use this page, the service connections page, service application associations page, to configure which service applications are connected to which web applications. A proxy group is a group of service application proxies, so a group of links, basically just that are selected for one or more web applications. If you create your own custom proxy group, like I did for my sites, that will only be used for that web application. So you can't reuse a custom proxy group. You will just create a custom one for each web application if you want it to be configured like that. And this is basically an example of how flexible you can be. You can see that we have three web applications, all with a lot of site collections underneath it. And we have a couple of service applications. We have two managed metadata service applications. We have one search, one user profiles, and one Excel services. And in this mess of lines, you can see that Portal consumes the managed metadata service applications, both of them actually, and search. My sites use search, managed metadata, and user profiles. And then the team sites web application uses one managed metadata service application, user profiles, search, and Excel services. So like this, you can configure web applications to use whatever service application you want them to consume. If you create a service application, you can use the farm configuration wizard, and that will create all service applications with the default settings. The default settings aren't best practices, so don't do that. Don't create your service applications using the farm configuration wizard. You can either create them manually, go to manage service applications in central administration and just create them via the UI, or if you want more control, you can use PowerShell. Be aware that just as the UI for the different service applications isn't exactly the same, the PowerShell commands aren't the same either. So properties might be named just a little bit different, even if they mean the same thing. So you need to check what your properties are actually are per service application. There's one service application for which you can use the farm configuration wizard, because there's no other way to create it, at least not through the UI, and that's the state service. So the best thing you can do is configure your web applications, either via the UI, via managed web applications, or via PowerShell. Create the service applications that you need, either through managed service applications or through PowerShell. Then go back into the configuration wizard and start the state service. That way, it won't create web applications for you, because even if you don't want it to create web applications and you cancel that bit, it will create your web application. It just won't create the site collection in it. Support for custom service apps. In SharePoint 2007, we had no way to create our own custom shared service provider or services for a shared service provider. Within SharePoint 2010, we can. And when should you need a custom service application? This is when you're providing heavy computations, doing a lot of analytics, stuff that's really, really heavy. Stuff that you might want to run on a different server even, because with service applications, we can actually activate a server on a certain server. So that will help you to scale out. You might consider creating a service application if you have to share data or information across site collections and web applications, if you want to execute a lot of long-running operations, and if you need a really robust scale-out strategy. You don't create a service application, or you shouldn't, if your data or features are specific to a particular site collection or a particular site template. In most situations, you should actually build features and not service applications, even though it's a cool thing to build a service application. But in most cases, features are good enough. This is the famous SharePoint slogan, just because you can doesn't mean you should. So think about it before you start it. And if you want to build one, just build one in a test environment for fun instead of creating one on your production environment. You have to think about a lot of stuff when you create a custom service application. So you have to do a lot of build a lot of the infrastructure around it as well. If we go into building our own solution, what we'll look at is ASP.NET and SharePoint similarities. Obviously, SharePoint is built on top of ASP.NET, uses the same languages, the same .NET framework and ASP.NET class libraries, although SharePoint can only use .NET framework 3.5 and not 4, which annoys a lot of ASP.NET developers. And we also use the same development tools. We just use Visual Studio 2010, just like any other .NET developer. A couple of essentials for SharePoint that you should be aware of if you are an ASP.NET developer. SharePoint provides a lot of out-of-the-box features. If you don't know anything about SharePoint and you start building a SharePoint solution, you might be rebuilding what SharePoint already has, which is a bit of a waste because, chances are you don't have the test resources that Microsoft had when they were building SharePoint. So you might be building something not as good as they build it and actually spending a lot of time on that. So anything that SharePoint does out of the box, don't try to rebuild that. Just use that out of the box and make sure you investigate if you have a requirement whether SharePoint can do that out of the box or whether you really need custom functionality to get that. SharePoint also provides a framework, so you can extend the framework, but don't try to change the framework. So respect the boundaries of SharePoint, respect what SharePoint can do, and don't try to turn it into a different platform than that it actually is. If you want to build your own framework, build your own framework, build your own platform, and don't use SharePoint. You should also tell your customers this. I get a lot of customers that want to change everything about SharePoint, but they do want to use SharePoint. I don't do that. You shouldn't do that. For instance, quite a common requirement, hide all features other than the features that the customer wants a user to see in a site collection. That will really limit that user. Hide all site templates other than one or two certain site templates. But they do want to use Safe Site as template for a user. You're going to hack your environment and then you're going to get in trouble because customers can't do what they want to do because they limit themselves so much. Also, you probably won't be able to upgrade. You will get into a lot of trouble when the next version comes out. And you know who the customer is going to blame if they can't upgrade. That's not the people that came up with the requirements. That's the people that actually built the functionality. So be aware of that. On that same line, never change out-of-the-box SharePoint files. It's not supported. It can be overridden with a service pack, and you won't be able to upgrade any of that functionality. If you are an ASP.NET developer and you start with SharePoint developer, then with SharePoint development, then SharePoint provides an API, and it can be a bit tricky in the beginning to understand how the SharePoint API is built up and where to find different objects and functions. The most important thing I find is to realize what the SharePoint hierarchy is. So we have farms, servers, web applications, site collections, sites, libraries and lists, and then items. So if you're not aware of that hierarchy, it's very difficult to build a SharePoint solution because you don't know where to find any of the functions. Also, in theory, everything that's in the UI is in the object model from SharePoint 2010 onwards. It's true for most features, but not for all features. It's a lot better than it was. We can certainly say that. The Sharpened Object Model is very powerful for building custom solutions, and it helps you to build custom solutions very quickly. Because of the functionality that SharePoint already provides, you don't have to build everything from scratch, and you can build pretty slick functionality in relatively little time, a small amount of time. You have to be aware, though, that especially the old SharePoint classes are wrappers for unmanaged code. So if you look at SPSite, SPWeb, SPList, etc., that's basically unmanaged code running and just being wrapped inside a managed object. So you have to know what objects you need to dispose. If you use any of these objects in your code, you should dispose them at the end of your functionality to make sure that you don't create any memory leaks. So there's a good article on MSDN about what you should dispose and what you shouldn't dispose. It's quite long and it can be very confusing. But luckily, we have a tool, SPDisposeCheck, which will help you to identify places where you maybe missed something that you should dispose. It sometimes throws errors where it shouldn't, so there are a couple of false positives in there, but most of the time this is correct. So always run SPDisposeCheck before you put any solution into production. And be aware of what your code actually does. So make sure that you know what objects you are creating so that you don't create any memory leaks or use SharePoint in a not-so-efficient way. A couple of gotchas, especially if you're an ASP.NET developer, things that are really weird. If you retrieve a specific item, for instance, you do splist.items0, so you get the first item from that list, that will retrieve all items in the list and then filter out the first item for you. So it won't just retrieve one item from the database. It will first retrieve all items from the database, and only then it will give you that one item that you were asking for. So it's a lot better to use splist.getItemById, which will actually only retrieve a single item. Also, if you have list throttling enabled, something that will limit the amount of records that you can retrieve from the database at any one point in time, using this is very useful because you will go around that. You won't get in trouble with the list throttling because you will only retrieve one item instead of, well, say, the 10,000 items that are in that table. If you want to get the number of items in a list, you can use splist.items.count, which again will first retrieve all items from the database and then start counting. And it doesn't count any folders, so this is quite relevant if you do need an accurate counter. If you use splist.itemCount, it won't retrieve all items, it will just do the count. It does also count folders, so you need to be aware of where it does or doesn't include folders, assuming that you're using them. So be aware that anything that has an S behind it retrieves everything from the server. If you have spweb.lists, that will retrieve all lists. If you have spsite.webs, it will retrieve all webs, even if you just need one. So try to use the functions that actually only retrieve a single item or the number of items that you need instead of retrieving all items from a database. Usually, this doesn't cause any problems on your development environment because you don't have that many items in there. If you go to a production environment that's really, really big, this will cause problems. So the minute you deploy your code to production, you get in trouble or the environment gets in trouble. This is another fun one for .NET developers. These two events, spweb.lists, event list, .enable attachments is false, spweb.lists events.update. That update is not done on the same object as the line at the top. It actually creates a new object, a new list object for you, and then does the update on that. So this doesn't work. In .NET, usually this works. In SharePoint, it doesn't. So no list will be updated if you use this code. You will do an update on the list that no changes were made to. So what you should do is first create the list object, like here at the bottom, get your events list, then disable attachments, and then do the update. For SharePoint developers, this is nothing new and makes total sense. But for a .NET developer, this doesn't make sense. A couple of other gotchas. SharePoint has its boundaries, so make sure that your custom app doesn't push SharePoint's boundaries. One thing that's quite common, you have an app that creates items in a list or documents in a document library, and all of a sudden you have millions of items in that list or documents in that document library because no one actually looks at the library. It's just the custom app that creates those things. Or you have a maximum number of sites that you should create at any one level, and you have an application that creates sites automatically. No one actually checks where that site is created, it's just created automatically. So at a certain point, your environment will stop performing. You will basically stop to a halt. And that can be because of all the stuff that your customer application was creating. If you're creating stuff through the UI, you usually notice what's happening and you know where you're creating something. But if an automated app is creating stuff, be aware how it will scale. Will it still scale if you have 10,000 items of whatever you're creating in your environment? Or should you maybe think of a certain hierarchy or different objects where you need to group the items that you are creating? So be aware of what you're doing. Because your custom solution can bring down an entire SharePoint farm. I've done that more than one time. It's not just inexperienced developers that do that. You have to be really, really aware of what you're building. Also, use SharePoint solutions to deploy customization. So never copy files to a SharePoint server just by hand. Always use a SharePoint solution to deploy it. The solution will make sure that permissions on the files are set correctly. It's just one example. It will make sure if you add another server to the farm that the customizations are deployed to that server as well, for instance. It's just a couple of examples. It will help you identify things that you need to upgrade if you do an upgrade to the next version. So never copy files manually to a server. I've seen a lot of people get in trouble, for instance, because permissions weren't set correctly and SharePoint couldn't read the files. So SharePoint was reading files from a different location than they were expecting it to read files from, or a different version of files. And even though you're using SharePoint solutions and Visual Studio will help you to build those solutions, you don't really need to know where artifacts are stored anymore, but make sure that you do know where your files go. So if you're creating an application page, make sure that you know that it's being deployed to the layouts folder. Make sure that you deploy it to a subfolder that's namespaced so that you don't get clashes with out-of-the-box files or maybe files that other people are building. If you're creating a web part, where is it being deployed? Does your DLL go into the INET pub, or does it go into the global assembly cache? It matters where it goes. It matters for how you deploy your next version. It matters for how you need to troubleshoot. If everything works fine and you don't have any problems, there's no need to know. But how many people build solutions that never had a bug in it? I mean, I would be impressed. Come and see me if you do. I know I have a job for you. Another topic or hot topic with SharePoint 2010 is Office 365. So we have a couple of development options if we want to do development for Office 365. We can build sandbox solutions. We can use the client object model to build our solutions. We can use a limited set of web services in our client object model. We can't use all SharePoint web services. They limited that. And we can use SharePoint and Excel services REST interfaces. So it's quite a list of stuff that we can use to create custom solutions within Office 365, but we will still be limited in what we can do. If we first look at sandbox solutions, a sandbox solution is basically just a SharePoint solution. It's a WSP file, like a normal SharePoint solution, but it will be uploaded to and deployed from the solutions gallery at the site collection level. So it won't be deployed to central administration, because obviously Microsoft doesn't like us deploying stuff to their central administration. It will just be deployed to the site collection. Because of that, it's completely isolated to that site collection, so we can't access any data outside of that site collection. Now, that's the biggest limitation. You can only access anything inside of your site collection. A sandbox solution is always deployed to the database, so where normally a feature would be deployed to the features folder in your SharePoint root folder on the file system, a sandbox solution will never be deployed there. So a feature in a sandbox solution will be stored in the database, and you will never see that on the file system. In return, sandbox solutions won't be able to bring down your entire farm. At best, you can shut down all the custom sandbox solutions within that particular site collection. But you can never bring down your farm. So that will limit the risk that you have if you let people deploy sandbox solutions. This is obviously if you leave the amount of resources that sandbox solutions can consume at their defaults. If you up the amount of resources that a sandbox solution can use, you can still have sandbox solutions bring down your farm. But we'll get into that in a bit more detail. This is where it's deployed. This is your solution gallery that you see in the screenshot there. And it's located at your site collection in the underscore catalogs-solutions folder. And you can upload, activate, deactivate, and delete sandbox solutions from there. You have to be a site collection administrator. A site owner isn't enough. But then you're pretty free to do whatever you want in there. Again, with the limitation that you can only access anything inside your own site collection. A sandbox solution runs within a specific worker process. So we have the SPUC worker process.xt for that. So it doesn't run in the W3WP worker process where all your farm solutions run in or where your SharePoint pages run in. That worker process has a special code access security policy set to it that has SharePoint permission.object model, security permission.execution and ASP.NET hosting permission level minimal set to it. So this will limit what you can do with it. There is a way to adjust this, but you shouldn't, because then you have a way to deploy solutions to your environment without any monitoring that can do real harm to your environment. Sandbox solutions can use a subset of Microsoft.SharePoint namespace. So they can't use all of it, it's really a subset. And you can only use the Microsoft.SharePoint use namespace. So you can't use any of the Office, Microsoft.Office, whatever. And sandbox solutions can be managed and monitored from central administration by a farm administrator. So you do have some insight in what sandbox solutions are doing. And also you can manage them in a certain way. So you can disable certain sandbox solutions completely. Make sure they can't be installed to the farm anymore. If you know that one sandbox solution that's going around within your company is causing damage to a site collection, for instance. And you can see how many resources are consumed and set how many resources sandbox solutions are allowed to consume. This is the subset of Microsoft SharePoint that we can use in a sandbox solution. So we can use Microsoft.SharePoint except for the SP site constructor, which makes sense because that creates a new site collection, which is not inside your own site collection. We can't access SP securities, also sort of makes sense. We can't use SP work item and SP work item collection, SP alert collection, .add. We can't have SP alert template collection, .add, SP user solution, because that would mean you can actually access either your own sandbox solution or someone else's sandbox solution from your sandbox solution. And we can't use SP transform utilities. We can use Microsoft SharePoint navigation, Microsoft SharePoint utilities, except for send email. Obviously, an email will be sent to something outside of your site collection. And you can't use SP utility.nt full name and email from log in. And we have the Microsoft.SharePoint workflow, which we can use, and Microsoft.SharePoint.WebArt pages, where we can't use the SP WebArt manager object, the WebArt connection. I don't really get that one. The WebArt zone, the WebArt page, the toolpane, and the toolpart. So those are a bit different from the others. The ones on this side are pretty clear why you can't use them. The ones on that side, I would like to use some of those to be a bit more flexible in my sandbox solution. If we look into the monitoring, a farm administrator assigns what's called resource points to a site collection. And those points are calculated based on 14 metrics that all have an impact on the health of your environment, on the stability of your server. The metrics are called resource measures, and they are normalized to what's called resources per point. So, for instance, one of the resource measures is the amount of memory that your solution uses, which is obviously specified in MBs. But you have also the amount of processor time or the percentage of processor time that your solution is using, or the number of unhandled exceptions that your solution is throwing. So all those are normalized to a number of resources per point. By default, you can use 300 points within a site collection within 24 hours. You can see that set here, assuming you can read it, probably. The over here you see user solutions resource quota. The maximum amount of points per day is set to 300, and a warning will be sent when 100 points are reached. In your solution gallery, the screenshot that we saw earlier, these bars will go up. The top one is the amount of resource today. The bottom one is the average usage within the last 14 days. If your average usage is zero or somewhere around here, you deployed a new sandbox solution and all of a sudden the usage today is going all the way to the end of the bar, you deployed something that's using too many memory or is consuming too much processor time, maybe throws a lot of unhandled exceptions. So you should remove that sandbox solution from your site collection and then look at what it's doing and why. Once you reach the end of the bar, you reach the 300 points, all sandbox solutions within your site collection will be shut down until the next reset, and a reset occurs every 24 hours. You can't force that in any other way. The only thing you can do is up the number of points, and I've heard especially developers say, you know what we can do, we can just put this on, 3 million points per day, and then we won't have any problems deploying any sandbox solutions that do whatever we want. But of course, that means that you can use all the memory on your server that's available and actually bring down your server with a sandbox solution. So never do that. If you want to up it a little bit or put it down a little bit, you can. But think about why you're doing it. And you know, people actually tested this and thought about this when they came up with these numbers. So they're not just random numbers. Here you can see what the resource measures are. Or you can read them for yourself or later from the slide deck. CPU execution time, critical exception count. You can see if we have an abnormal process termination, one termination is enough for 1 point. On the other hand, we need to use processor time, so percent of processor time, 85%, is 1 point. So that counts up a lot slower. So these metrics are based on the impact that they have on your server. A bigger impact, more resource points. Totally makes sense as far as I'm concerned. Some of the functionality that we can build in a sandbox solution, list definitions, instances, an onet.xml, so we can create web templates. We can't create site definitions. We can create content types and fields. One thing that we can't do, which is pretty annoying, to use a nice word, is access managed metadata fields, because the metadata is actually outside of your site collection. It's stored in the managed metadata service application, but that's a pretty big limitation. We can use navigation navigation modules and files, feature callouts. We can create web parts as long as they are derived from system.web.ui.web controls. Which they should be anyway, so that's very all right, no problem at all. We can create event receivers on items, lists, and webs, so anything within your site collection. We can create custom actions, and we can create workflows. So we can still create quite a lot if you look at this list. Some stuff that isn't available, we can't create custom action groups. We can't use the hide custom action element, so we can't hide default menu items using sandbox solutions. We can't create web application and farm scoped features. Well, that was kind of easy. We can't create timer jobs, also pretty obvious. Application pages, because they have to be deployed to the layouts folder on the file system. So we should just use the pages within SharePoint. And we can't create our own web services within a sandbox solution. A couple of workarounds that we have for the limitations. On-premise, we can create a hybrid solution with a full trust proxy. A full trust proxy is a farm solution that we deploy to central administration as a farm solution, and that will allow your sandbox solution to maybe do logging, something that you will use quite a lot and that a sandbox solution by default can't do, but with a full trust proxy you can. We could use external lists by using the SP list, so use BDC to connect to data outside of your environment. And we could create custom workflow activities as full trust assembly and then reference those. In the cloud, on Office 365, for instance, obviously we won't be able to deploy full trust proxies. That would be very nice, but we can't. What we can do is use the client object model, and that will mainly allow you to cross the site collection boundaries. Client-side object model has no problem with crossing the site collection boundaries. And we can use a limited set of the SharePoint web services by using the client object model. be aware that the client object model is SharePoint Foundation. So stuff that you can do in there is access search, access user profiles. That's stuff that you will probably miss if you want to create more complex solutions. I want to use search a lot in my solution so I don't have to iterate over stuff. But you can't do that in a sandbox solution. Here is how the client object model is actually retrieving data from the SharePoint database. We have the content database at the top, SharePoint data in it, and then we have the SharePoint API, the server API that's talking to that. We have, depending on what you're doing, the web services here and the client object model here, or client SVC and the client object model here. So the client object model talks to client.svc, which talks to the server API, which gets data from the database. It's just the amount of calls that you can do that's limited. So in the end, the SharePoint server API is always used to get data from the SharePoint content database. It's not like the client object model is talking to the database directly. Or the web services, for that matter. So SharePoint itself uses the server API to talk to the data, to get to the data within SharePoint. This client object model is a unified object model across all clients. There are three different APIs, the .NET CLR, the Silverlight CLR, and the JavaScript CLR. And which one you use depends on your use, you know, the type of solution that you're building, the kind of functionality that you want to have. All APIs offer a subset of the server API. That's completely logical. You don't want the full server API to be downloaded to every user's computer whenever it loads your solution. That's way too big. So they had to cut it down to a reasonable amount of options so that it's actually downloadable for a normal user as well. And again, it's the foundation object model, so nothing from server available in there. A couple of key differences when you're developing on the client. You have limited APIs. Another thing is you have to do explicit execute query calls, so your code won't talk to the server until you call execute query within your code. So you can do a lot of stuff, prepare a lot of stuff in the client, and then you do a call to the server every once in a while. You don't want to call to the server for every statement because that will cause a lot of traffic and well, that will slow down your solution. For JavaScript and Silverlight, we can only use async calls, so that's something to be aware of. If you're used to developing on the server, it's quite different if you have to work with async, with the async object models. You need to establish a context. When you run the server, you know in which site you are, so you always know your site context when you're developing a solution. If you run the client, you need to establish that first, so you need to tell it in which site it is. You need to give it the URL of the site, of the context that you want it to work in. For .NET and Silverlight, you have the full URL context, and for JavaScript, it's a server-relative context. If you want to look for them on the file system, you can see where they are deployed. The .NET CLR is deployed to the ISAPI folder. It has two DLLs in it. The Silverlight CLR is deployed to the template layouts client bin folder, also two DLLs in there. And the JavaScript APIs are deployed to the layouts folder, and there are three JavaScript files that you can use the functions from. This is an example, just very basic example of what you would do if you, what are we doing? If you change the title of your site and you're using the server API. You get the context of the current web first, so just you're asking for your current context. You request the title, you adjust the title, well, you tell the site that it allows unsafe updates, and then you update your site. Very simple and straightforward. For instance, if we use the .NET CLR, first thing we need to do is establish our context, so we establish our client context by filling in a URL in there. Then we open up the web. Then we actually load that web into the client context, and then we execute query. So only here we're talking to the server. All this is done without talking to the server. Only once we call execute query, we're actually communicating with the server. Then we can change the title. We can ask for the title and then adjust it. We can update the site. If we stop here, no site will be updated. So only when we execute the query, we're actually talking to the server again and updating our title within the database. So that's something to be aware of. It's a different way of thinking. So if you start with client object model development, you have to get into the right mindset and be aware of what's different than what it would normally be. If we want to create templates for Office 365 sites, we won't be able to use site definitions or provisioning providers to do that. So if you have Office 365 2010 right now, and you also have a SharePoint 2007 environment, and you want to upgrade that environment into the cloud, and your old environment used site definitions, you're out of luck. The only thing you can do is a data migration. So you can't upgrade the database, because updating the database would require the site definitions to be available on the target server on your 2010 environment, and that's not allowed. So, there's no way to do that. You can't deploy your own custom site definitions to Office 365. And even for an on-premise environment in SharePoint 2010, you shouldn't create custom site definitions anymore, because these restrictions will only be stricter for the next release. A site definition has to be deployed as a farm solution, so that's one of the main reasons, and site definitions are deployed to the file system. What we can do is use site templates, save site as template from the UI. It's obviously limited, but saving a site as a template creates a sandbox solution, a WSP file, that's stored in the solution gallery when you save it. So that will create an easy way to create your templates, but you can't use publishing sites in there. So you are limited with that. And obviously you're using whatever the user is clicking together. We can also use web templates, which are created by a developer and created in Visual Studio. Have their own onet.xml. You can add code to that once, whenever the site is created, when the site is provisioned, you can add your own features to it, it can be deployed as a sandbox solution. Obviously, if you put features in there that use the server object model stuff that's not available in the sandbox, it won't work in a sandbox solution, and it won't work in Office 365. But if you think about what you're developing, if you're just creating a template with some lists on it, some web parts on it, there's no problem with that. And you can do that and then deploy it to Office 365 as a sandbox solution. So even if you're creating on-premise solutions and on-premise templates, you should use web templates and not site definitions. Be aware of that. There's a lot of documentation, or blogs mainly, out there about web templates. How you should create them, and what the differences are between the site definitions and the web templates. So a couple of the basics in here. A web template uses the web template feature element that was introduced with SharePoint 2010. You will see that a lot of the stuff that's new, that's being introduced in 2010, and that will be worse in the next version, is related to Office 365. Helps Office 365 to run their services and helps you to use Office 365. If you're creating a web template feature, you can deploy that as a site or a farm scoped feature. One of the two. You can't use web or web application scope. If you create a site scoped feature and you put a web template in that, you can deploy it as a sandbox solution. If you activate that solution, it will only be available, obviously, within that site where you activate it. It won't be available throughout the farm automatically. Even if you deploy it as a farm solution, you should still activate it in all the sites where you want to use it. If you create a farm scoped feature and you activate it once, then it will be available, that template will be available throughout your environment. You can create site collections based on it from central administration, and you can create sites on it from every site collection within your environment. So then, basically, your web template will function as a site definition. It will work exactly the same. What you need to do is, when you build it, you have an elements.xml file for the metadata of the feature, and you have an onet.xml file. So there's no webtemp.xml file, which in SharePoint 2007, in your custom site definitions, basically defines the metadata. So it had the title and the configurations in there. So no more webtemp files, but elements files instead. A web template inherits from a site definition. It's between quotes because it doesn't actually inherit. You need to mention a base site definition in your web template feature, So you need to tell it what it inherits from, but it doesn't use any of the functionality from that site definition. So all of the functionality that you want to use should be in your web template, onet.xml. You can't just assume because it's in that base site definition that it will automatically be in your web template. The good thing about this is a site that has been created using a web template will only know about the site definition. It has no memory of the web template that was used to create it. So it will refer to the site definition on the disk. Which is good because those should all be out-of-the-box site definitions, which means that effectively your site created using a web template is a site that was created using the site definition that you marked as the base and then customized while people were working on it. And that will help with your upgrades because for SharePoint it will just be a site based on that one site definition. So when upgrading it will look at that site definition as well and you don't have to migrate any site definitions or web templates. Also, because your site has no knowledge of your web template, you can adjust it for, if you want to create new sites in a little bit of a different way, you can just delete the old web template and add a new one in. Which with a site definition you couldn't. You're not allowed to change the site definition after a site has been created based on it. So it also introduces a lot more flexibility to you. It's a lot easier to maintain your templates. It's still changing a web temp, just like changing a site definition, doesn't adjust any existing sites. So existing sites can only be adjusted either through the UI, through script, or through code. If you're using web templates and you use Visual Studio to create them, you can use the publishing feature in that. So it's more flexible, it provides you with more options than if you were using a SafeSite as template as an end user. And using web templates is both Office 365 and upgrade friendly. We'll talk about deploying our solution just for a tiny little bit. SP web config modifications are used to make changes to your web config. It's a SharePoint element, a SharePoint function. However, it can only make changes to the SharePoint element of your web config file. It can't make changes to any of the other elements. Also, using SP web config modifications can't influence the order of elements properly. And in some cases, that matters. Deletion of any elements using SP web config modification is very tricky because you might end up with corrupt XML within your web.config. And having a corrupt web.config means your site is inaccessible. If you have a farm with more than one SharePoint server, so for instance you have a couple of web frontends and application servers, using SP web config modifications is unreliable. So my advice is to not use them. Now, I know that that introduces a problem because in some cases you have to adjust the web.config files. So I would either use ASP.NET code and adjust the XML within your web.config. Maybe use a template that you deploy in your solution, in your WSP file that you use. Or even I would rather make manual changes to my web.config file than to use SP web config modifications because then at least I know why my file is corrupt and where I made the changes. I know it's a difficult one. There's not a real good answer to this one, but be aware if you use SP web config modifications how much problems this can cause. I've seen this stop a deployment for a really, really large farm for a public website for 2 months. We'll now look into maintaining our solution for a bit. So the myth here is that upgrade is easy. Now, upgrade is never easy, regardless of what you're upgrading. And the SharePoint framework is no different there. We have now upgrade possibilities for SharePoint features and SharePoint solutions. So we can upgrade them. We don't have to retract them and put new ones in. But what we have to do is plan for upgrade of features and solutions beforehand. We can't upgrade everything, and we have to think about whether we actually want to use feature upgrade or maybe we just want to still retract like we did in the old days. Implementing isn't that difficult, but it also isn't very easy, and you have to come up with the right strategy, and that's the most difficult part. You have to think about what you want to do with your upgrade before you even start building your first version. And that's pretty tricky because you never know what the customer is going to ask for next. You know they are going to ask for changes. I mean, no solution stays in a version 1 unless it's not being used. but you never know what it will be. So you have to do a lot of thinking about how you are developing your first version to make sure that you can get to a next version if you have to. So if you want to upgrade a feature, when a new version of a feature is created, this may involve incrementing the version number of an existing feature. You have to do that if you want to use feature upgrade. Adding new XML to define new elements for the feature. So for instance, add fields to your content type. You can't delete files from fields from a content type. You can only add them. Maybe writing code to execute in the feature upgrading event of the feature receiver. Usually, that's the easiest way to do things because you can do checks. What's the state of your site? Maybe the site owner modified something, and because of that, your upgrade won't work. Then you can check that in your event. You can check it in code and do whatever you want to do to your feature, to your site, from the code within your feature upgrading events. If you want to find features that need upgrade, so that are outdated, basically, you can use spsites.queryFeatures and then use the upgrade method. The upgrade XML could look like this. So I highlighted a couple of things. The version here is 1.0.0.0. The version range, so the versions that this XML applies to are from 0.0.0.0 to 1.0.0.0. Then we apply manifest, so that's just your elements file, so we have the my upgrade slash elements. So that could define my extra field that I want to add into my content type, for instance. Here we have an add content type field, so we want to add a field to this content type, and we want to push it down, quite important, because otherwise it won't be pushed down to any existing usages of that content type. And here we define a custom parameter. So we have a custom upgrade action. The function is called run some upgrade code. And we have a parameter in there with a library to upgrade. So you can give some data to your feature upgrade function through this XML. If we want to upgrade a farm solution, what we would do is upload the updated solution package using update SP solution. So we need to have access to the farm to do this because we need to upload this into central administration. If we want to upgrade every instance of our feature within the entire farm, we could either run psconfig or run the SharePoint configuration wizard. This does the same thing. It will go through all the sites within your farm and upgrade your feature. This does mean that your site is down for a little bit because you have to run the configuration wizard. It will also warn you when you do this that it will take your site down. But at least everything's upgraded. If we just want to upgrade one site at a time, we can use spsite.queryFeatures and then feature.upgrade. So we have to be aware that just running update SP solution, your solution will be updated, but your features won't be. The existing instances of your feature will still be the old instances, will still use the old functionality. So that's very interesting to be aware of. You need to think of how are you going to update your existing instances of your features, or maybe you aren't, which is also possible. On the other hand, if we have a sandbox solution, the strategy is a bit different. We will upload a new WSP file to our solution gallery, and it needs to have a different file name, because otherwise we can't upload two files with the same file name, and it would need to have the same solution ID as the original file. We would have to press the upgrade button in the solution gallery to upgrade the solution, and with that, the new solution and features will be activated, the old solution will be deactivated, and all the instances in subsites of that site that were using that feature are upgraded immediately. So you don't have to do anything extra if you're upgrading a sandbox solution. So it's important to realize the difference between a sandbox solution and a farm solution if you are using upgrade. Different behavior in there. Now, so I mentioned most of these already. Feature upgrade does not happen automatically if you're using farm solutions. Another interesting thing is the version range element that we saw in the XML. Begin version is inclusive, but end version is not. So it will, if I list 0.0.0.0, everything that has that version is included as well, and the end one the exact version is not included. So you don't have to say upgrade everything from 0.0.0.0.0 to 0.999. You can just say 1.0.0. If you want to clean up your environment, you maybe want to remove a custom solution. You have to be aware that retracting your solution will deactivate all features that were used and clean up some of the files. It won't clean up all of the files. And the main reason for that is that SharePoint won't touch anything that could potentially cause data loss. This is also a problem if we actually want to delete something. Deleting a field from a content type that's in use is pretty much impossible, because it will always be locked by SharePoint. So what it won't delete if we delete our solution is existing site definitions, for instance, any content type features, site column features, and a lot of other things aren't deleted either. So if you really want to clean up, then you have to write feature receivers to remove the files that you deployed with that feature. Obviously, you have to be very careful with that as well. Just like SharePoint, you don't want to cause data loss for any users, so you want to make sure that you don't delete data that is still needed. And also something that I've done before is whenever you know, we created a timer job that also added a lot of data into MMS, so you know, full taxonomy. Whenever we removed the feature that deployed that timer job, we would also clean up the MMS again, which means that all your sites that use that metadata break. You can't, you know, update those files anymore because that metadata is not available in your MMS. So you have to be aware of that. If you clean up like that, you might get into trouble as well. In general, if you're working with SharePoint, it's very, you know, straightforward. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Just because, you know, SharePoint introduces some new fancy feature doesn't mean you have to use it. Just because you can modify something doesn't mean you have to, you know, exhaust every option to modify SharePoint. Don't try to push the SharePoint boundaries. The SharePoint boundaries are documented pretty well on the internet. Make sure you respect them, because if you don't, it will definitely slow down your environment and possibly even make it unusable. If you're creating a custom solution, plan for growth. Don't just plan for your development environment, plan for your production environment in at least a year's time. Make sure that it can handle a lot of users or a lot of sites. I made that mistake once. I created a web part with an overview of the sites that a user had access to. It iterated through all the sites within my environment, worked perfectly on my development environment. And we put that on the homepage of our internet. So the minute we deployed that to production, 40,000 users were iterating through all the sites that they had in the environment. Not a good idea. It literally broke down the internet for a day. So be aware of what the impact of your solution is on the production environment. If you're iterating through stuff, how many items of that, you know, whatever you're iterating through might be in your production environment? Not just today, but also in a year's time. In general, you don't want to iterate through stuff. It's not always a feasible solution, but you really want to think of a different solution if you can. Don't trust everything you read on the internet. There's a lot of misinformation out there about SharePoint. There's a lot of explanations of how you can do stuff that's not supported within SharePoint. So you can do a lot of stuff that's not supported within SharePoint, but you will still lose your support, even if you got it from the internet. So you know, be aware of what you're doing and make sure that what you do, what you get from the internet doesn't break your environment and also doesn't make you lose your support with Microsoft. I would encourage everyone to be creative with their custom solutions, also on top of SharePoint, but don't start hacking. Personally, I'm not a big fan of JavaScript that iterate through elements and try to find the X element that has this GUID in it that then modifies something in the UI. You can do it, but I would consider that a hack. Modifying SharePoint files, also a hack. Are there any questions about any of this? Go ahead. The question is if there are any limitations with feature upgrade, or whether upgrades everything within the feature. You basically specify yourself what you're upgrading. So either through XML or through the code in your feature receiver, in your feature upgrade receiver, you specify what it does. So any of the code in your upgrade feature receiver will be run and will be processed. So in that sense, yes, it upgrades everything within the feature. But anything that you don't touch in your upgrade won't be upgraded. If you have new files, assuming that it's supported to add those files to the existing feature, then those will be added to the feature. Some stuff obviously still isn't supported, overriding stuff. But if you can do it through feature upgrade, then it should be supported and you should be able to do that. Go ahead. You want to move all content from one web application or from two web applications into a single web application. Well, you could create your new web application and move your site collections in there. That shouldn't be that much of a problem to move those. You could even attach an existing content database to a new web application, the same way that you would do if you move it across an environment. So you can take the database offline, create the new web application and attach it to the new web application, and that would add all the sites within that content database to your web application. Obviously, if those two web applications contain sites with the same URL, that will crash. You can't have sites with the same URL within a single web application, so you would have to make sure that that's not the case. But otherwise, you can do it. It's pretty straightforward. Any other questions? Good question. The question is, what about feature stapling? Feature stapling can't be done on web templates. So you can't staple anything to a web template, which in a way is a shame. But the main reason we were using feature stapling was to make sure that we could adjust it after we created sites based on the site definition. With web templates, we don't have that problem. We are allowed to change the web template after we created the site based on it. So you can just list all your features within the onet.xml of your web template, and then afterwards adjust that onet.xml again and just deploy the new version of your web template. So it's remediated. Any other questions? Thank you very much.